Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Slate's Double X Gabfest is sponsored by Smith & Noble, featuring custom window treatments handcrafted to your personal style, design, and color preferences. Get 20% off your window treatments plus a free in-home consultation when you go to smithandnoble.com/xx. And by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code XX at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. And by NatureBox, shipping tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, you'll never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox for free by going to naturebox.com/XX. That's naturebox.com/DOUBLEX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Double X Gabfest for Thursday, May 28th. The Thou Shalt Cruise edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Good morning.
So in after our last edition, a reader wrote in and scolded me for not mentioning the name of the reporter who wrote the nail salon expose, which indeed was very unsisterly of us. So I want to do that now. It's Sarah Maslin Neer, and we spoke about that on the last episode, and it was indeed fantastic. So all props to Sarah. Sorry about that. Okay, our three topics for today. Let's jump in. First, the wife bonus. A new anthropology of Upper East Side society wives discovers this little retrograde practice of rich husbands handing out a year-end to their glam sams, glamorous stay-at-home moms. Second, what was gay and where did it go? Brian Lauder comes on the show to talk about camp and cruising and where they have gone. And third, bridesmaids. It's wedding season, the matching dresses, the virginal pretense. Why do we keep it up? Okay, let's start with the wife bonus. Last week, we all learned this terrible phrase. It comes from a new book by Wednesday Martin, which is an anthropology of the tribe of Upper East Side wives. Martin, who lived among them, analyzes them the way Jane Goodall did the chimpanzees, their habits, their hopes and dreams. But one idea, actually, do chimpanzees have hopes and dreams? We don't know that.
I love the thought of it. Yeah.
They might. So I'll just keep that in. The one idea that stands out is this idea that wives wait for their year-end bonus from their husbands to decide, say, how much money they can spend on their next spree. Okay, so who wants to describe the wife bonus and what it's based on and what goes into deciding it, as according to Wednesday Martin?
Well, the wife bonus is a very small part of the book, right? Her new book, The Primates of Park Avenue. The Glam Sam's wife bonus gets only a couple of pages, pretty far into the book. But I don't know if that's because she saved it for the New York Times or whatever, because in the book, at least, she seems to have buried her lead. But it's kind of the concept of these women gave up their careers and they were, for the most part, very, you know, highly prepped and highly credentialed. And they gave up their careers to kind of, you know, make the life for their husbands in this world. You know, it's the woman's job to find the apartment and you know, tend to all the needs of the child, which are legion and not the kinds of needs that anyone else in the world has. And they also often have to travel for the sake of their husband's career. And so their compensation is just as their husbands in their Masters of the Universe jobs get annual bonuses, so too do the wives for their performance of tasks like, you know, building up the prestige of the family or keeping her body in shape or, you know, making sure that her kids don't have an accident and end up with a dead tooth.
Allegedly. This is allegedly a thing that happens on the Upper East Side, although the evidence that she actually cites, I would say, is pretty scant.
Okay, let's talk about, well, okay, we can go to that first. Is it true? Now, one, there was a very convincing article that ran in Business Insider by Polly Phillips. It was originally in the Daily Telegraph,
right,
who said she was such a glam Sam and she had given up her career, that she and her husband had decided he was restationed in Australia. She, too, was equally ambitious, as is often the case these days. These are generally women with business degrees, and they've met their husband at some fancy business school. This was not their secretary, a la the Mad Men days. And so she said, you know, she explained very calmly why initially she was embarrassed about such a term, but in fact, she came to appreciate it. Now, that's not to say that it is a widely practiced thing, but there's really no way of knowing from the book. It's presented, the thing that's difficult about this book is that it's presented as an anthropology, mm-hmm. and so it puts us in an academic frame of mind. Like, when I picked it up, I actually thought it was an academic book that the New York Times had, like, sort of cleverly picked up on and honed in on this one concept, but that turns out not to be true. It's like kind of memoir-y. It's not really. It's written by a woman who was trained as an anthropologist, but it's not a book of anthropology.
It's weird, though, because she does spend a lot of time, like, establishing her credentials. She mentions her background in anthropology about 100 times just by page 7, and then throughout the book, she never lets up with these sort of comparisons to either famous anthropologists' observations or what monkeys do. And honestly, I found the book quite readable, and except for those bits that just, you know, made my eyes glaze over. It's, you know, if I want to read anthropology, I'll read real anthropology, not popular anthropology.
It's a total ripoff of the concept behind Mean Girls. I forget what the name of the book that Mean Girls was based on. It's like Queen Bees and something, something, something. But the whole concept is like that teenage girls are like lions in the Serengeti, and they travel in the pack and they prey on the weakest. And she even has in the first chapter references to the Serengeti. It's just like the concept has been done, and that bothered me on a like creativity level.
I felt like she wasn't sure which way she wanted to go, that she was still trying to protect her academic credentials. And frankly, I actually wish this were an academic book, because I found it fascinating, but I wanted a lot more detail and rigor in this portrait. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought she was in a unique position to have earned their trust and been part of that community. And if she could have done it in conjunction with Columbia University, and like, I know that's a little uptight, but like, I really was curious, you know, and instead the portrait was a little vague, you know, it was stuff that I could have guessed not having read a book. Right. Like, they spend a lot of money on Birkin bags, and they love SoulCycle, and they are, you know, really crazy about which private schools their kids get into, and that's a big status symbol, and they say bitchy things to each other in the hallway, and they get Botox and stuff like that. But except for the wife bonus, it existed on a level of vagueness.
I felt like for all her attempts to establish that she was an anthropologist and that she, you know, knew so much about this field, she absolutely failed to be a participant observer, because she claimed she was. It's like, you know, the lady doth protest too much that that's what she is, because she, you know, her menstrual cycles synced up with those women. You know, she became one of them. She wanted to, you know, she got the Birkin bag and she dedicated herself to getting the tight bod, and she, you know,
Wasn't she honest about that?
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. You know, she talked about how participant observers do go native. But, you know, when the professor, you know, spends time with Yemeni tribesmen, that later when he invites his student over, he acts like a Yemeni tribesman. He's not a Yemeni tribesman, but I felt like she did become a Upper East Side wife, and she lost her role as an observant participant. She wasn't one. She was one of them. She became one.
So why are we all obsessed every time something like this comes out? What is it about rich women who don't work that kind of compels us to just sit in judgment and jealousy and some kind of potent combination of all of those things?
Big jealousy is part of it. But I do think there's something very salient or something about these overeducated underachievers. I mean, they could be mistresses of the universe, but they very pointedly have chosen another path, but they still can't resist challenges, and it's just that now their challenge, these impossible challenges, aren't to make this amazing deal and earn $1 million, but to get the apartment, which they describe as being so impossible to do, even though you're, you know, paying the millions of dollars is the least difficult part of it, or getting your kid into a private school, which is a gross thing, but we, you know, if it's a big challenge, we, you know, we approve somehow of their using their skills. And if it's about, like, you know, getting the enchufe, getting the you know, the connection to get in, to get a Birkin bag, even that seems like using the skills that they've developed for some productive thing, even though if you think for a moment, of course it's not, it's nonsense.
I have like a very second wave response to this, and it rises in me like a tidal wave of anger, so much so that I couldn't even finish the story, and I couldn't defend it or articulate it that well. And when I did try and articulate it, say to my daughter, she laughed at me. So like I was saying, like, the waste of potential. It's, I don't have any jealousy. I have just pure horror of dependence on anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were gay, it would be my wife. I'm not. It's my husband. I just, it's like a pure horror of sort of putting myself in that position of extreme vulnerability, where I am dependent entirely on somebody else and their whims in order to live my life. So part of it is that, but I can't articulate it that well. My first stab was the wasted potential. So the way that, you know, the kind of we're clogging up the pipeline. These are the women who would be Sheryl Sandberg, you know. And so my daughter's response to that is like, who the hell needs more of those? Like, why is it that everybody has to choose the same path? Like, what, you think that their destiny should be to be hard driving business women and that would make them happier? Like, in some sense, the things that they're doing sound fun and sisterly. Like, yes, they live in a gendered segregated world. Yes, gender segregation is eternally associated with inequality, right? Like, places where you have women living in separate worlds, which is another alarming revelation of this book. You know, they go on trips together. They hang out with other women all day. They rent private planes, you know, and go to islands where they have, and they all dress the same. It's really like reading about Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. But is that unfun? Like, do I not wish I had more time with my girlfriends? Like, does everybody have to be, like, you know, leaning in all the time?
Yeah, Hannah, I have a very, I don't know if it's third wave or what, but I feel suddenly the need to defend these women. In the sense that we talk a lot about on this podcast and in the larger feminist conversation about how work-life balance is such a shared goal of all of ours, and yet we are sort of demeaning people who have decided to apply the same rigor that they would apply to work to life, right? Like, it is hard to get an apartment in New York City. It is hard to raise a child, and they are, like, taking their MBA degrees and, like, mastering life, if not, you know, quote-unquote, the universe. And I think there's something, you know, it's extreme, obviously, yes, to only do that. But are we really saying that work is always more important than family and life and those things?
Yeah, that was my daughter's reaction. For example, Wednesday Martin does start the book with her apartment search. You know, they decide to move to this neighborhood, and mastering the apartment search is incredibly difficult. Not just the logistics of it, but the psychodynamics of, like, how you have to deal with the broker, how you have to dress before the broker, how you have to address the person who already owns the apartment. There seem to be like a billion anthropological rules that you have to master just to get a freaking apartment, you know? So it does seem like it would take a whole lot of time to figure that out in this separate tribe. Well, then, Noreen, that brings up the second thing, which is, if we do believe that it does take a lot of work to master life, which it does, then, you know, another eternal feminist conversation, shouldn't it be paid?
Right. And that is the wife bonus that may or may not be happening, which we are all horrified by. But, you know, in a separate, if we were talking about less wealthy women, we would be saying, well, childcare should be valued, mm-hmm, and X, Y, and Z. I think there's just some sort of, like, prejudicial thing happening where we are, you know, the phrase Birkin bag makes our skin crawl, mine too, you know, like, it's kind of a gross idea. But in some ways, these men are, this actually happens, they're valuing their wives more than a guy who, like, asks her to do all these things with not so much as a thank you.
Yeah, I mean, when I read the testimony of the actual woman who said she'd been paid a wife bonus, that piece in the Telegraph, that felt much more gentle to me. Like, it felt like they had sat down and made a conscious decision that this is how they wanted to run their lives. It seemed to me, you know, it was like a choice, non-choice. Like, there was no chance that that he was going to follow her to her job. You know, that just didn't seem like it was an option. Nonetheless, they did decide consciously together. They wrote it down. They made an agreement of what her duties were going to be, how she was going to get paid. It did seem like a work agreement. So, you know,
it doesn't seem that horrible to me. I mean, again, like in the 80s and surely before then, there was this campaign that was very much from the left, the, you know, wages for housework campaign, which, you know, asked in part for payment, but also just for women's unpaid work to be calculated as you know, as part of GDP and all of those things, which don't seem at all outrageous. And so is it just that these are extraordinarily rich people and we find their lives kind of gross or what? Because it doesn't, it really, the concept of it or the underlying philosophy of it seems really pretty progressive somehow.
I think it's has something to do with the word wife as yeah. opposed to like just as a thought experiment, what if it were a mothering bonus, right? I think mm-hmm. we would be less. There's something about the fact that, like, it's wife implies you're taking care of your husband as opposed to taking care of your children or your own household or whatever. Just, like, wife has a whiff of, like, you know, chattel to it.
Well, there was
in that context.
In that piece in the Telegraph from the actual Glam Sam who got a bonus, she said she preferred to think of it as a partnership premium rather than a wife bonus. And maybe, you know, it's kind of participation in the family, just like a partner in a law firm would get a check at the end of the year. So that's her check for being a partner in the domestic arrangement that they're in.
Then, can I twist this one more time? I always have the Catlin Moran has this are the men doing it rule about mm-hmm. anything that happens. And mm-hmm. it's like, no freaking way. You know, you just, it's very, very hard to imagine the opposite among very rich people. Like, there was a great New York Times demographic that ran recently about the places where the women are working the least. And the two places in America where the women are working the least are Appalachia and the Upper East Side. So, and you can see the little dots on the map showing yeah. that. So it's like, there is something just painful about the fact, you know, and again, that Michael Lewis column, which I refer to often, How to Put Your Wife Out of Business, which was his parody of, you know, marry a really rich, successful woman and put her out of business. And that's the mark of status for an important man. And he was joking, but like, it's not funny. You know, here it is again. It's like for this particular demographic of men marrying this particular demographic of women and then shutting their public ambition down still rankles even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because I always find the glamorous lives of extremely rich people appealing, but I did not find their lives appealing. I don't want to have to, you know, go to these particular kinds of exercise that make you want to vomit or that do make you vomit. I don't want to, like, the things that they do, I don't want to do. So that's kind of an achievement because I generally find the lives of the super rich super appealing.
Well, the rich of America now, the status symbol, the ultimate status symbol in America right now is discipline,
yes,
right? And
yes.
And it's not like the glorious age of gout when that was,
right.
like, you know,
right.
eating as much like lard as possible was how you showed your wealth.
Yeah, I'm still gouty me.
All right, well, we're done with the rich then. Let's move on to our second topic, what happened to Gay? But before we do that, we want to thank our sponsor, Smith & Noble, the window treatment company. If you, like me, are happy to stare at bare windows for months because you're too lazy to do otherwise, then this is the company for you. I recently redid our house, and by the time I got to windows, I was spent. So thank God for Smith & Noble, so you can order fast, get lots of help before, in my case, I get bored. In my case, we bought honeycomb shades for kids, heavy drapery for the bedroom. It was all easy and modern and really great looking. An expert designer comes to your home, works with you one-on-one, measures, orders, and installs. Smith & Noble has an incredible offer for our listeners. Save 20% off your window treatments, plus get free in-home consultation. For a special offer, go to smithandnoble.com/XX today. That's smithandnoble.com/XX. So let's move on to our next topic. What was Gay? You can feel nostalgia creeping in for a time when being gay meant being distinct, different, special, when people could tell you were gay by the chandeliers over your dining room table. In an increasingly accepting world, homosexual men are all too eager to leave their campy cruising world behind, writes Brian Lauder in his latest Slate blockbuster, What Was Gay? We have Brian on today to talk about this piece. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
So let's start in the most basic philosophical place. Is there such a thing as a gay apartment?
I think mine's pretty gay. Yeah, well, so I start the piece off with that sort of idea because I think it's something that's easy to see the difference between gayness as something on a level of culture and homosexuality as a sexual orientation. So you could walk into any apartment and presumably not know how that person has sex that lives in that apartment, right? It would be pretty difficult to tell that. But you can walk into my apartment and I think a number of other gay men's apartments and say, ah, this guy's gay. How do we know that? Like, how is that being registered in that space, right?
And is it acceptable, I guess, is another question you ask. Like, it wouldn't be cool for me to say what I just said if I walked into your apartment and didn't know a thing about you and said, oh, you're gay, when I walked into the apartment. We don't say that anymore.
Yeah, I think the political moment that we live in now makes that, like, less, like, impolite to sort of say something like that. But what I wanted to do in this piece was say, you know, you're not wrong to recognize that thing. And actually, I want to talk about why that thing is special and why we might not want to get rid of it in the end.
Brian, I'm curious because, well, I have two questions, I guess. Let's start at the beginning. So in that first, you know, in that apartment scene, mm-hmm. when you talk about what the things are, some of the things that sort of, you know, identify it as a gay apartment, a lot of the images are literally images of strong women, as mm-hmm. you call them, or some of them, I would say, are actually troubled divas rather than strong women.
Shade.
Yeah.
But why are those women and those sort of particular female images so much a part of gay iconography, do you think?
Ooh, that is a huge question.
I know.
There's like whole books about that. I can speak for myself, I guess. For me, so in my apartment, we're talking about like an image of Shira. We have this huge sort of pop art painting of that. We have the movie poster from All About My Mother, the Almodovar movie. We have a lot of like cartoon drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race. So all of those images to me are about people sort of on either sort of campy figures or people like on the margin. So in All About My Mother, that movie is very much about people who are sort of struggling to make sense of a difficult life. And so I think the diva icon has always been about that to some degree. Mm-hmm. This is why I don't really think Beyonce is a great diva because she's not struggling. There's no sort of tragedy there. Other of these figures have. And so my partner Cam and I have surrounded ourselves with these images, not really on purpose, but just over time. And so we sort of at some point looked around and realized that this is what we've done. And this is clearly central to our gayness. Mm-hmm. It may not be to everyone's, but right. for us it is. Yeah.
And one of the most interesting parts of the piece for me was when you walked through the history of how and why gay as like an adjective and way of life came about, mm-hmm. As separate from homosexual. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's important to keep that distinction in mind throughout this. So it's like not all homosexuals are gay, and that's sort of the place from which we start. For my purposes, the history bit starts in the late 19th century, so when you have sort of the invention of the idea of homosexuality. It's not to say that people didn't have same-sex sex before that, but that's the moment when, as far as we can really tell, sort of medical authorities, legal authorities, the church, a lot of these sort of mainstream authorities elaborated this idea into like a type of person. So we moved from acts to people, and so the homosexual is invented. About the same time, you have this cultural mode that's invented. You know, we could get into a lot of detail about that, but you get something that's sort of eventually called gayness, and it's not about sex, actually. It's about all these other cultural markers. It's about, you know, a comfort with effeminacy, possibly. It's about aestheticism, dandyism. It's about attention to detail, decadence. A lot of the stuff that we associate with Oscar Wilde, who's a big figure in this, comes about right at the same time. So at the very beginning, you've got the homosexual and sort of nascent gay culture, and these things develop in tandem throughout the 20th century until sort of our moment, which is when there needs to be a decoupling, I think. But yeah, that the 20th century was the century of gayness, for sure.
And then you conclude that section, or you move towards this idea that defenders of gay are so uncool these days that they would get booed from the room.
Yeah.
So why is that? How did we make that switch? Why does gay and homosexual, why did it need to separate in order for us to reach equality?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main word here is assimilation. Since the 90s, I mean, since the 90s especially, we've had sort of the main thrust of the gay rights movement has been about access to conservative institutions. So we're talking about military service, marriage, and similar signs of mainstream acceptability, right? To do that, the main strategy has been to downplay gay difference. So the sort of rhetoric of we are normal, this is a small part of me, we're not that different, you know, the only thing different about me is who I love and nothing else. That has been the argument, and it's, you know, been espoused by lots of people, but especially someone like Andrew Sullivan and Virtually Normal have been sort of saying that argument, and it's worked really well. It's gotten us a long way towards getting those kinds of rights. But we've also lost something, right? It's many gays were different and had something special to contribute to human life, American life, however you want to define it. And pushing that away has been one of the things we've lost. And it's sort of, to me, very sad. So I started this piece from a place of trying to recuperate that a little bit and understand how we could preserve gayness and gay cultural practice, even as a lot of homosexual people are going to assimilate into sort of a mainstream life. And those two things are fine. They can exist. They can coexist if we let them.
June, did you see the Q&A with Alison Bechdel, who was recently on this show, in which she talked about this subject and about how there were some things when she started doing her cartoons, she was doing it explicitly for what she perceived to be a distinct and tiny lesbian audience. And so she also was nostalgic for this moment when, you know, being gay was something special. It was like distinct. You were part of this oppressed minority, and there was something almost, you know, liberating in that identity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I definitely respond to that expression because I definitely have experienced it too. I mean, it's funny, when I did a series about gay bars, it's kind of this exact same kind of confluence of, if I never have to go to a gay bar again, I will be happy. On the other hand, every time a gay bar closes, it, like, you know, a bit of my soul is chipped away, and I just, you know, I mourn it. Mm-hmm. But because, I mean, and there is this weird sort of, there's a thing, nostalgie de la boue, you know, nostalgia for the mud, which is like a kind of craving for the, you know, the bad old days, which in some ways is terrible. That's an awful urge. At the same time, you don't want to be too cleaned up and too perfect. You know, like, there was something really important in that feeling of, gosh, we're all in this together and we're all out on the side. And I don't know, there's a feeling in that, a feeling of family or something that I think will be really missed.
And you also don't want to feel like you have to clean up to be accepted. I mean,
right,
that's kind
right.
of the one of the things I'm pushing back against a little bit in this piece is the idea that, like, the only way to achieve equality is to erase anything interesting about our history, our past. That sucks. Like, I don't want to have to do that. And that's actually not real. That's actually not a real achievement. It's actually you're just conforming to a thing that's palatable and not actually forcing anyone to grapple with anything difficult. You know, it's nostalgia, like you said, but it's also, I think, a political position. It's
right.
Like, you know, I should be able to be as flaming gay as I want and be included in our society. I shouldn't have to be sort of picket fencey suburban to be seen as a good gay, right?
Mm-hmm. So as I was reading the piece, I kept thinking about kind of a corollary argument to yours, which is, okay, if gay life has gotten more straight, straight life has also gotten more gay. Mm. And you didn't talk about that as much, but you see it everywhere. Like, RuPaul's Drag Race is like a hit show. You know, Glee arguably is a version of gay culture. And do you think that that also necessarily represents kind of a whitewashing if, you know, this is like a watered down version of gay culture that straight people have appropriated, or is it heartening?
Yeah, appropriation is such a funny word. I don't know that I believe in it exactly.
Okay.
I mean, that's a different question, but it's definitely true that, like, certain gay, let's say, tropes, maybe people say this about camp all the time, but, like, camp sensibility has sort of become a very mainstream thing. I think aspects of it have, definitely. But even Drag Race is an interesting example. I think when that show started, it was much more subversive and sort of queer and, like, probably not very palatable to straight audiences as it has become. As it has become more, you know, more known and more of a thing, I think it's sort of toned itself down. I mean, June, you've watched it. I think it's gotten much more like sort of packaged for a wider audience, which is cool in certain ways. I'm not against that. I'm not saying that we should keep all this stuff to ourselves and be separatists, but it does necessarily change the way something's pitched or the tone when you're thinking about it for a sort of everyone versus a gay audience.
But but what you said, Noreen, makes me think of something that is in the sort of toward the end of the piece, Brian, of almost like a concept of gayness separated from homosexuality, mm-hmm. that you could have straight gay people.
Yeah.
You know, we all know those strays too, but that's another thing.
What is about that? Like, if you can be homosexual without being gay, can you be gay without being homosexual? I did wonder about that. Like, do we move to a place where people can adopt gay identity because they love it?
So what I try to do in the piece is distill gayness down into some just like practices. I want to get it away from specific icon, like, do you like Joan Crawford or not? Which is the way a lot of people have done this, talked about this issue before. I try to sort of distill it down to these sort of key life practices, life skills, right? When you do that, when you think of it that way, I think that does make it accessible to other people. You know, you have to understand where it's coming from and sort of the history of marginalization and all of that. But I think anyone can adopt these practices. And actually, one of the most delightful responses I've gotten to this was my editor, John Swansburg, saying that he hopes to raise his daughter to practice cruising, as I define it, which is not just a sexual thing, but sort of a way of approaching life and paying attention to detail and nuance and that kind of thing.
I
thought that was beautiful. Like, isn't that great? Like, that's awesome.
Can I just say how much I love that part of the story when you rebuild gay? I mean, how I perceived it is it wasn't like an angry piece. You weren't saying, you know, shit, we've lost everything. It wasn't like the debates that we had in the early years, in the beginnings of the gay marriage movement.
Yeah.
This had a completely different tone to it. And that section where you were building gay identity back up, I felt like I was reading like Joseph Smith, like, here comes the new religion and here are the tenets of that new religion. And here is the Bible. And like, people will cut out that thing and put it on their walls because it was so different than anything else I'd read about how you build this back up, like that paying close attention. Can you explain that? Because I thought that was super interesting concept and what you mean by it.
Yeah, I mean, the first concept I sort of start from is I put it under the word cruising. So when you say cruising, what we're usually talking about is a sort of sexual practice whereby you would walk around the city and we're talking about gay men mostly in this case, walk around the city, lock eyes with someone, you know, notice subtle shifts in, you know, maybe body language or expression or whatever, and know from that you could possibly have sex with that person or pick that person up. And this is like not something that happens as much now. It was certainly like a sort of a more 70s thing. But that's what cruising meant historically. However, if you think about how that works, it's all about attention to detail. So, and really subtle details and the way a person is sort of carrying themselves in relation to you. And so to me, that is like what gayness is about at core. It's about paying attention to the world around you in a very specific, careful way. And it extends from sex out into, you know, code switching, paying attention to how you style yourself around other people, whether that's to protect yourself or to attract a certain kind of attention. I also think that it actually is what camp is about at root. It's about paying attention to the wrong or to funny details in a thing that you're not supposed to be paying attention to and get a lot of pleasure out of that.
Thou shalt cruise.
Yeah, thou shalt cruise. I mean, I think that's it.
It reminded me a lot of how people talk about the construction of the Jewish cultural identity. You know, Jews weren't allowed to own property, so there were certain ways that they have to behave around money, and then stereotypes arise around that, but you can actually get to the root of the religion and the Jewish identity and talking about sort of how they were treated in European countries. It was that kind of close analysis.
And I definitely, too, you know, like, as a lesbian, my first response to reading that section of the piece was like, oh, we don't do that. Oh, no way, we do. It's just we maybe don't do what's typically thought of as what we typically associate with this word, but the behaviors that you're describing are something that everybody does, I think, you know, in terms of finding the people who are your companions, finding your people, you know, the drag aspect of, you know, just seeing gender or all these things, which in some ways are considered to be innate as performance of code switching, of, you know, of queenliness, of just kind of taking and seeking an outsider perspective. And then family, I mean, that definitely I think we all are aware of kind of creating families, but, you know, certainly say in a lesbian context, you have the family of exes, which I think probably doesn't quite exist in the same way outside. So there, I mean, it is, I think, a way of thinking that all kinds of people can relate to.
Well, one of the coolest responses I got to this piece was from Matt. I think it was from a Slate Plus member, wrote in to say that she's straight and her husband is straight. They're married for, like, I think 40 years or something. She identifies as gay, by the way I'm describing it, and her husband identifies as lesbian, but culturally, right? Right. Yeah. So she very much resonated with this, but they're totally straight. So I think it's fascinating. Yeah. I love that. I think that's...
So, Brian, since you're generally not judgmental when you write, you're not really. You're careful. You're not that judgmental. You're not a hater. What is the future that you envision as good? Like, is it a future of choice? You know, some people can be this way, and, like, some people can be like Nate Silver,
right,
who says what? That he's ethnically straight.
Yeah, he says sexually gay, but ethnically
sexually straight. Gay, but ethnically straight. That there's just a wide variety of choices. Is that what you would like?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing with this piece is I'm not trying to force this as gayness as I'm defining it on anyone. It's not about saying you're not gay enough, which makes you bad. It's about saying that we've gotten to a point where we can choose, and that is kind of an amazing sign of progress in a way, that we've gotten to a place where you can choose to be totally culturally straight, you know, get married, have kids, blend into that sort of lifestyle, and that's great and awesome. And I think, you know, a lot of people want to do that, and they should. Other people should be able to choose to be gay in this way without being judged themselves. So the issue is not so much me judging sort of quote-unquote straight-acting people, but them judging me or judging people who are more gay. I mean, but like I said, assimilation has been the key word for like 20 years now, at least. And part of that has been saying that people like me who are really culturally gay, who organize our lives around gayness, are somehow retrograde or stereotypes or not with the program in some important way. And that's messed up, too. And I want us both to be able to live our lives the way we want to. Right. And not see either thing as being in the way of each other.
About being in the closet? Does that count? Because that's a gay tradition in a way, and I wondered if that's included in this wide panoply of choices.
That's provocative. The closet's complicated. I would generally say that if you're able to be out safely, you should be. There are cases, especially like teenagers who are dependent on family support, maybe you shouldn't be, but I tend to think once you're you know, sort of out on your own and able to support yourself, you should come out, because it's...
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things that may be traditional, but they were coping mechanisms that are actually very damaging to the psyche and the soul. And I don't know that everything that used to exist needs to be preserved. But...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, choices without pain. Brian, thank you so much. That was fabulous. And it's a great story. You should read it. It's called What Was Gay? And it ran in Slate.com by Brian Lauder.
Thank you so much.
Let's move on to our next topic, bridesmaids. But before we do that, we'd like to thank our second sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is a site that helps you start your own website. I have been working on one with my son, which I talk about a lot on the show. This time, we actually helped his best friend set up a rival site. It was quite generous of him. And he also got to be a teacher for his friend. They have lots of different templates and choices. The interface is easy. They have a feature called Cover Pages, which makes it intuitive and lets you figure out in very little time. It looks really nice on any device, including a phone. There's a 24/7 support via live chat and email, and it's only $8 a month. And a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a year. When you sign up, make sure to use the offer code XX, that's DOUBLEX, to get 10% off your first purchase. We thank Squarespace for their support of the XX GabFest. Okay, let's move on to our final topic, bridesmaids. There really isn't anything about wedding traditions that isn't retrograde and sexist, but the bridesmaid presents a particularly difficult case. On the one hand, girlfriends, fun, Vegas, and on the other, gender segregation, virgin protection, matching dresses, the expense, and the stress. Oh my God, it sounds like the Primates of Park Avenue. It sounds like a moment when we all get to behave like the Primates of Park Avenue. Anyway, okay, Noreen, I kind of need your help on this one, because I am wondering if it's just uncool. Like, if when your friends or people your age or around your age are called by another friend and said, you know, and it's announced like, you're going to be the maid of honor or you're going to be one of my bridesmaids, does one just inwardly roll her eyes?
No. And this is what's interesting about, I think, the bridesmaid tradition is that by, if you looked at how culture and interpersonal relationships have evolved, you would think that, like, this would have gone, you know, out the window. But there is still something lovely about somebody saying, you know, you are one of my five best friends in the world, and I want you to stand up beside me as I, like, tell this man I love him forever, or this woman, or whatever it is.
You're so nice.
I know.
Well, I've been a bridesmaid a few times, and I can't, you know, and it's been a really wonderful experience, and those women are all dear to me.
Are you telling us the truth?
I don't think any of, well, maybe one. Anyway, that is a true thing I'm saying there. However, being a bridesmaid is a logistical hassle from hell often for a lot of women. And again, shout out to Maura, Ellen, Chrissy, and Rose for being great brides. But for a lot of women, it just becomes this moment when you're a princess and these are your ladies in waiting. And it doesn't matter if they don't want to spend kajillions of dollars on, like, your special day. I think that is kind of the sticking point for a lot of people when they're asked to be bridesmaids. And there are forums on the internet filled to the brims with people asking, how can I politely decline? This costs too much. I found a CNN article from 2011 that said that the average cost of being a bridesmaid is $1,700, which when you compare it to the average cost of an American wedding, which is something like $25,000 or $30,000 at this point, isn't that much. But then you think about it and you're like, okay, this is a person who just merely for being a friend is being asked to spend a couple thousand dollars on bachelorette parties, you know, on party favors, on multiple shower gifts, on the dress, on the shoes, on the matching jewelry.
And the hotel.
On the hotel. Oh, my God. Hotels are such an expense, and the flights. And it does add up. And so you really, your summer becomes, you know, kind of taken up by someone else's wedding.
Well, now, Hannah, you're the only person among us who's had a wedding. So were you a nice person to your bridesmaids?
Yeah, but I regret every tradition that I followed in my wedding. I really did not. Like, when I look back on it, I can't believe I did it. And I wonder how I got swept away in it. So I got married, you know, not young, like not young for this earth, but young for this demographic. So I was 27 and I had a lot of good friends. And I did make them wear like a color. And
what
and
was it? What was your color scheme?
It was just blue. And they, you know, there was like lots of different choices. And I had it done at this store that I really liked to shop at. And it seemed all cool and hip at the time because it was like the seamstress and she could do these different cuts. But what the fuck? Who cares? Like, I can't believe I did that. Like, I don't mind that I brought my girlfriends up with me. And David actually had a female groom's whatever. How do you even say that? And that was so radical that Glamour magazine did a story about
They
did a picture of our wedding party in which there was a girl on his side who was like his really, really old friend. So that's embarrassing too. And I just cannot understand what and actually the reason that it made me miserable is because I felt left out. Like, I felt like my bridesmaids, now that I have designated them such as my ladies in waiting, were kind of a group apart from me. And I had all these different obligations. Like, I had obligations to my family and my family coming in from Israel and my family coming in from Queens and my in-laws. And they were their own little ladies in waiting posse who I wanted to hang out with, but I actually couldn't because I had these other things to do. And I just feel like something about the symbolism of the uniform made it a whole lot worse. Like, if they were just wearing their own damn clothes and then they would just like hang out with me and it would all get mixed up together. But no, they were like a separate group and I wasn't there. It was miserable. And I look back and I'm like, why? Why? What? You know, I'm so not a person who generally follows tradition. So why did I do it?
I do think that the uniform and the separate group thing, it's actually kind of fun when you're actually at the wedding. You have like, you know, you might not have met these other women before, but you're like taking these photos together and you are easily identifiable to one another. Like, if you're ever sort of at a loss for what to do, you like spot another pink dress and you're like, there are my people, I can go. And you sort of stick out at the party because you're wearing the uniform. So like, you're a mini celebrity at the wedding. You can be like the fun bridesmaid, the drunk bridesmaid, the like super sweet bridesmaid. It all depends. But why do you think it's so uncool, Hannah? It strikes me that, like, you're embarrassed about it. I don't know. That's weird to me.
I am, and I can't tell if the objections that you talked about, a lot of logistical and financial objections, is that really what it's limited to, or is there something bigger about it? There was a review in Salon by Michelle Dean of Bridesmaids called Am I Doing Being a Woman Wrong? And she was basically really irritated by all the sexist tropes that arose in this idea of bridesmaids and the hostility of female friendships and how the whole thing, you know, all these women were supposed to support their girlfriend, but only if it didn't make them look bad or make them pissed off about their lives because they didn't have a man. And the whole thing had to lead up to, you know, we're happy for you because you have a man and you're leaving us now. And there was just a lot of irritation. It was beyond just like the money and the logistics that you're talking about, Noreen, and that one reads about. There was some anger in being put into this kind of archetype, like shoved into this archetype of womanness.
That's the modern archetype, right? Which is that there's anger at the person who's made you do this whole thing in this dress, you know? But there are also warmer visions of it in pop culture. This is a little older of a movie, but I feel like 27 Dresses, classic, like, Lifetime or Oxygen mainstay 27 Dresses starring Katherine Heigl, shows someone who is mostly happy to be a bridesmaid and to support her friends. But then she has to, like, I don't know, she has to come to some kind of healing about herself in the dresses.
And it's really nice and inspirational. No, there's that element of it. I don't know why I'm embarrassed. It didn't go right. Maybe it just didn't go right. Like, why did I feel excluded? It didn't happen the way I see it in the movies, where I felt like, yeah, this was my sisterly support and it was all about me. Like, I experienced it as a set of, like, competing obligations in which I couldn't relax and do what I really wanted to do, which is just hang out with the ladies.
It seems to me that there is this sense that being a bridesmaid is a sacrificial role, that you kind of give up your own volition and your own desires and you do for once what this person who is your peer wants you to do. And that it's weird that sort of the pop culture is telling us that that's something that we should find objectionable or we should be jealous of, because yes, as we described earlier, there can be a lot of expense and inconvenience, but that it's just something you're doing for your friend. And, you know, especially if you are getting married, you know, in your 20s or early 30s, where perhaps you're at a stage in your career where you're still having to do what people who aren't necessarily consistent and reasonable just tell you to do, and you have to just give in to random orders, that this is a chance for you to have a kind of a moment of reversal where you can just, like, declare by fiat that everyone is going to wear yellow dresses with ruffly sleeves, and, like, they just go, yes, ma'am. And that seems kind of lovely.
I think that's such a good insight. And also the idea, you just blew my mind with the idea that, okay, it's a sacrificial relationship in some way. And that's not, I feel like our culture believes that you must sacrifice yourself for your romantic relationship, but not necessarily friendships. And this is sort of a literal representation of that, where there's like this romantic relationship being celebrated, but you as a bridesmaid have this supporting role where you're, you know, doing some minor things for friendship. And aside from the cost, it's actually not that hard to be a bridesmaid. You sort of like pour the bride champagne and tell her she looks pretty and lift up the train and all that. It's not such a hardship.
And June, you also remind me of another thing, which is that I think maybe there are certain roles and rituals, and they happen around big ceremonial moments like weddings and deaths, that we are loath to give up, that no matter how much we believe in individual freedom, mm-hmm, and Americans are uncomfortable with just playing roles, there are certain ones that we hang on to for exactly this reason, because we have so few of them. Mm-hmm. So the tradition of men asking women to marry them, right? Like, there's no reason why that should continue, and yet it absolutely continues in, like, you know, 98% of cases. And mm-hmm. So maybe bridesmaids is like that. It's like a moment where you are playing a role, like the uniform is part of that role. You're supposed to do different things. You're supposed to think of yourself as sacrificial. And it's essentially meaningless because the rest of your life is not really like that. Okay, well, let's move on to our recommendations. But before we do that, we want to thank a new sponsor, NatureBox. NatureBox left us some treats. They left me some treats, yummy Greek yogurt pretzels, Parmesan popcorn, which I have totally eaten my way through. They are super tasty and satisfying. You can choose from over 100 healthy and crave-worthy options, and they are delivered to your door. All of their snacks have no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, no trans fats, and no high fructose corn syrup, and they taste really, really, really good. So next time you're hungry, grab sweet blueberry almonds, salted caramel pretzel pops, and Parmesan garlic pop pops. I wasn't sure what pop pops were until I ate them. So they're just popcorn. Anyway, if you go to naturebox.com/XX, you can get a free trial of your favorite snacks. That's naturebox.com/XX. Okay, recommendations. June, do you want to go first today?
Surely. So I have been reading Brian Burroughs' new book, Days of Rage. The subtitle is America's Radical Underground, the FBI, and the Forgotten Age of Revolutionary Violence. And it is amazing because even though I, you know, kind of was alive then, and so he's talking about the 70s, and also I've always been obsessed with Patty Hearst and the SLA, and I've read, you know, I kind of read a book about that at least one a year, but I didn't know as much about the Weather Underground or the Black Liberation Army or some of the other organizations that he kind of chronicles. And it is just amazing to think how recently there were just bombs going off and that young people were kind of writing revolutionary manifestos and, you know, declaring that, you know, that they wanted to bring death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people. I mean, it seems unbelievable that this should have happened so recently in, you know, the very land that we still tread. You know, the weather exploded a townhouse just literally yards from where we in New York are sitting right now. So it's a really great book. And these movements often had very prominent women members, Bernadine Dorn in the Weather Underground and Assata Shakur in the Black Liberation Army and so on. So I highly recommend Days of Rage.
So there are two recommendations I have. One is League of Kitchens is a website. David got me this for my birthday. It was the most amazing birthday present ever. So basically what happens is you go to someone's apartment and they are an incredible cook from whatever country they come from. In this case, it was a woman named Nuida who's from Afghanistan. And she, of course, lives in Queens, like 5 minutes from my parents' house. And we were in New York, so we walked to her house. It was like she is the most awesome woman ever. Like you're just like, God bless America that such a woman like escapes from Afghanistan and Pakistan, makes her way here, and then teaches this little cooking class in her little kitchen in Queens. And the food was amazing and she was amazing. It was just like one of my favorite experiences ever. So it's called League of Kitchens, and you know, it's only in New York now, but if you live there and you are into food or even not into food, it's like a fun experience. You should do it. So that's my first recommendation. My second one is, this is a story I've listened to now a couple of times. It's called The Living Room. It's a podcast on Radiolab. It actually came out in April. It was originally on Love and Radio, and then Radiolab reran it, and it is amazing. It's by this woman, Diane, I think it's pronounced Weipert, I'm not sure about that. And it's a story of her witnessing another couple through the window, a young couple. And the entire thing is told like Rear Window. She's just watching their life and this kind of tragedy that befalls them through a little window that she can see because they have no curtain and they're this young couple. And that's how the whole story unfolds. And it's really, really amazing.
God.
Okay, Noreen.
I also have two recommendations. The first is a new album that I've been listening to the past couple of days. It's called Ratchet by Shamir Bailey. And I guess he is kind of like a gender bendy, post-gender, like, you know, 19 or 20 year old who's the next big thing. But the music is just really, really fun. And he sings in a falsetto and some of it's really dancey. And it's like, if you like Prince, but you're a little bored with the Prince catalog and want something that goes in different directions, you'll probably like Shamir Bailey. So whatever you like a kind of dancey thing for, whether it's work or running or dancing, check it out. And then the second thing is a Twitter feed that has been bringing me great joy in a very simple way. It's at Every Color Bot, and it just tweets in the same way that, you know, some of these dictionary accounts just tweet every word ever. This one is tweeting every color, and it's just really pretty. It sort of pops up in your Twitter feed in between everyone like talking about the news or television. It's just like a block of beautiful color with like the number code for what the color is, and you just have a moment where you're
that
like,
that is so awesome.
Yeah, it's really fun.
That sounds great. All right, Well, thanks to our producer, Anne Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our wonderful intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply, our show page, slate.com/xx, for more information about this specific show. Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Please, please like us. We need to catch up to the other Slate Gabfests. And there you can start a conversation, tell us what you think we should talk about in the next show. Email, if you want to be more private, XXGabFest@slate.com, and subscribe to us on iTunes so other people can find out about our show. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again soon.
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Well, everyone is minus, you could call me multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could give five fingers and I'm not waving high. Guess I'm never ending.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.